You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a Wisconsin film director joins us to talk about her upcoming documentary about women and girls involved in high-speed motorcycle racing.
First, President Trump sent Congress a list of immigration changes he'd like to see in a statement released yesterday. The president said any legislation that would protect DACA recipients would have to include those changes.
Trump's immigration wish list includes building the border wall he campaigned on and a crackdown on sanctuary cities and immigrants who enter the country illegally.
Hiroshi Motomura is a professor at UCLA School of Law. His books include Immigration Outside the Law. Hiroshi, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what are some of the key measures on this list from the administration?
Well, there are a number of them, some of them have to do with enforcement. Some of them have to do, for example, with the building of the wall, having to do with employer work authorization checks with a computer database. Some of them, though, reach far more broadly, and they get into questions of who can be allowed to immigrate to this country, what categories are going to be allowed, what the numbers are. So it's a very far-ranging set of provisions. It's not just enforcement. It's really an attempt to restructure the immigration system in the context of deciding what to do with the so-called dreamers.
Before we get into some of the details of the specific items, there'd been some thought after President Trump had talked to Chuck Schumer, Senate Minority Leader, and Nancy Pelosi, House Minority Leader, that he might be moderating his stance on some of these issues, including the ones you just mentioned. This the release of these requirements would not be that. They'd be much more conservative, much more hardline on immigration, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's right, and that's a fair way to characterize it. I think this is, in some sense, the intersection of the substance of the matter, which is what the consensus might be on what to do with the Dreamers. The intersection of that with perhaps the collision of that with some of the political context here. In other words, that I think a lot of what the president was saying about Dreamers was a position that my guess is that he himself holds and a lot of people in both parties hold. And I think what you're seeing here is a list of requests or demands or a wish list, whatever you want to call it, that really tries to use this political moment to get a lot of other things adopted that really weren't part of the original context.
And if this were to pass as written, and it seems like there's a lot of controversy about this in Congress, but what would happen to the Dreamers themselves? Is there an indication of what the president would want in terms of their future?
Well, I think that one of the issues on the table with regard to the Dreamers is exactly how long they would, first of all, what they would get. I mean, it's really what it comes down to. In other words, would they just get protection from deportation? Would they get permanent resident status? In other words, green cards? What would be their path to citizenship, if any? So there's a lot with regard to what the Dreamers would get in the legislation. So, and that was always going to be negotiated. What the new step here is adding a lot of other things that don't relate to the Dreamers, but relate to everything from enforcement to a restructuring of the whole immigration system as we've seen it since the 1960s.
One of those big changes to the structure of immigration would seem to be a move away from family-based claims of entry or family-based requirements, so you know you have somebody in the country already, that makes it easier for you to get in, to what they're calling a skills or merit-based system. What would that look like?
Well, the skills or merit-based system really is a shift, as you say, in the number of people allowed on one general basis, which is family reunification, to skills-based, and to really not only shift it more toward deciding immigration qualifications based on education, not only shift that, but also to reduce the numbers of immigrants in general, which is an equally important move. I think one of the important ways to think about this, though, is that people don't just divide up into people coming with family and people coming with skills. Many people who immigrate based on family, of course, have high skills and make an economic contribution. And so in many ways, it's the people who come on family basis and have skills, and that's a great number of people, who end up making the biggest contribution, because it's the family-based It's the family structure that often allows people to get the jobs and to really find the place where they're going to have their economic niche. I would also emphasize a lot of people who are so-called low-skilled workers are actually performing jobs that help American businesses compete in a global economy. I mean, can't forget about that either.
We're talking to Hiroshi Motomura from UCLA's School of Law, looking at proposed changes to the U.S. immigration system, conditions laid down by the White House for changes that would affect the DREAM Act and DACA recipients. Let's look at the enforcement side a little more now. First of all, the wall, obviously a big part of President Trump's campaign. What is laid out when it comes to funding for the wall and border security?
Well, this is also, the details are a bit of a moving target, but we're talking about the wall, although when we say the wall, I'm often unclear as to whether we mean a physical wall and something looks like the Great Wall of China or something, or really just a fence with a lot of technology. But that's obviously a very costly item. There's been a lot of back and forth, of course, about who's going to pay for it and pressure put on Mexico and that sort of thing, everything from that to you know, import duties that actually American consumers would pay. So there's that. And then beyond the physical wall, I think part of the proposals include provisions that would more severe measures to send back children who are arriving at the southern border of the United States. And so that's another set of things. So part of the enforcement here that's being asked for is interior enforcement, but the part you're talking about, which is both politically and pragmatically important, is enforcement on the border.
I wanted to talk about that issue you just brought up of unaccompanied minors, many of them fleeing El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, often fleeing gang violence. What would change in this list of requirements here?
Well, I think it'd be easier to send them back. One of the proposals, for example, is to limit their ability to make claims for asylum. I'm not sure it's being phrased that way, but I think that would be the effect. And to make it possible for the government to turn people back and send them back more quickly. You know, one concern about that, before we even get to the policy ramifications, is that the United States has signed on to treaties and conventions that require the United States not to send people back where they would be persecuted. I mean, this is really a legacy of World War II and of the Holocaust, and resulted in the Geneva Convention on Refugees. And so part of what we're talking about here is calls into question U.S. adherence to international law obligations that it is voluntarily assumed.
Staying with border security and enforcement, the White House also calling for more judges, I believe it is, to expedite reviews of people caught at the border. What kind of changes are we looking at there?
Well, it's clear that we need more immigration judges in this country, because what's happened is that immigration as a phenomenon has grown, just a lot of questions, a lot of cases that need to be decided one way or the other. So there's no doubt that the system is under-resourced from that perspective. I'm a little, more than a little concerned, though, that if the proposal is to hire more judges so that they can do a particular thing, it really makes me question how neutral and how fair the system is going to be. It's a bit as if you say we need more judges to put more people in jail, as opposed to saying we need more judges to decide cases fairly. So I think everyone would agree that the system is under-resourced from this perspective. But it seems important that judges be put in a position where they can basically decide the cases according to the law.
As we start to wrap up, Hiroshi, a lot of items on this list of demands. What do you make of the politics as Congress starts to look at this list?
Well, I think what we have here is we have a population of students, about 800,000 students and former students, and people who basically qualify for the DACA program. And I think there's been an emerging consensus, and certainly not unanimity, but a great deal of support for granting them some kind of legal status in view of the way they came to this country. And so I think what you're seeing is in the first stage, when President Trump made the announcement that he would work out a deal, I think he was really speaking in terms of the merits, in terms of the substance for a lot of people in both parties. I think what's happening now in the politics is that the White House, or at least some people in the White House, realize they have a bargaining chip that a lot of people are in favor of, and they're really trying to tack on as many things to it as possible. I think what will happen is that, you know, that a lot of people in Congress who really do support some kind of a legal status of some kind for the Dreamers, there may be enough of them to override what's going on in the White House. Especially keeping in mind that from everything that I can tell from the outside, that there is a back and forth within the White House itself on exactly what to tie to the legislation regarding the Dreamers.
We'll leave it there for now, Hiroshi. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Hiroshi Motomura is a professor at UCLA School of Law. His books include Immigration Outside the Law. He joins us to look at immigration demands President Trump has tied to any legislation protecting DACA recipients. An upcoming documentary follows a group of Wisconsin women and girls with a passion for flat-track motorcycle racing. Angels of Dirt was shot over a 10-year period and celebrates the fearlessness of getting on a bike and chasing your goals.
At the center of the film is Charlotte Keynes of Greenfield. She passed away after a racing accident last year at the age of 20. She's been riding and had been riding motorcycles since she was 4 years old.
This is Charlotte's second time dirt bike ride, and she's doing really good all by herself. Looks like she's trying to pass somebody. She's getting a little wild. She thinks she's racing already.
My name is Charlotte Evans. I'm 9 years old. I've been racing for 4 years. I've been riding for 5.
Wendy Schneider is the director of Angels of Dirt. She's a Madison-based filmmaker. Her previous films include The Smart Studio Story. Wendy, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, what got you interested in making a film about motorcycle racing?
I am a lover of motorcycles. I have one myself. And coincidentally, as I would drive from from Madison to Milwaukee, on the right-hand side of 94 is Aztalan Cycle Club, and I would watch the motorcycle races whenever I would drive by. So I became curious about the riding that was going on there, showed up to a couple of races, noticed that there was a number of young girls who were racing motorcycles, and thought it'd be interesting to start interviewing them. And that's really how the film started.
And you started, this is some years back, so you've seen these young girls grow up racing, isn't that right?
Yeah, it was 2006 when I started the film. I met Charlotte Keynes the first day that I showed up at Aztalan and spent the next 3 years shooting her and a number of amateur racers and a few pro races throughout the Midwest.
And let's talk about Charlotte Keynes. She is a big part of this story. She's from Greenfield. We'll get to some of her racing career in just a bit. But on a personal level, meeting her as a 9-year-old and watching her grow up on the track, what made her special?
There's a lot of things about Charlotte that made her special. I think her humility, her drive, her sweetness, her intellect, and her talent racing were really what drew me to her and to a lot of people. You know, Charlotte had an incredible racing career, a very short racing career, because it was just a year ago that she crashed and lost her life at Santa Rosa Racetrack. So the film took a turn after the loss of Charlotte and has really become, she's really become the thread that's going to help tell the story of the fearless girls that race motorcycles.
And yeah, these are fearless people. This is stuff that looks to me, as someone who's not done it, very, very dangerous for girls, boys, and grown-ups, for that matter. What is it that makes these people do this?
Well, I equate it to doing something like climbing Mount Everest. I don't think that you do it because you're fearless. I think you do it because you think you can. But having that access to be fearless is what gives you the experience to become who you are in relationship to any passion, you know, that you want to live out. So I think with Charlotte, Nicole Meese, Morgan Monroe, Shayna Texter, all of the women that are featured in Angels of Dirt, it's there's an element of fearlessness, but there's an element of full confidence that they're embodying and feeling when they're approaching motorcycle sports.
And these are girls and women you're following here. Is this a sport that's mainly dominated by men?
Well, I think I always struggle with the word dominated. I think it's just been traditionally open to more men than females. I think that the roles that young girls are given young girls are rarely given the role of motorcycle racer on the list. And so I think, young girls, young women who do find that they have the support to go into this, this environment, it's there. I mean, that's what Charlotte found, and that's what many of the racers find.
We're talking to independent filmmaker Wendy Schneider about her latest project, Angels of Dirt, a documentary about Wisconsin girls and women who race motorcycles. And Wendy, for someone who's never been at a track, set the scene for us. What's it like to be there?
It's usually hot, it's dusty, it's loud. There's great track food, burgers, brats, beers, and sodas. There's a great group of people out at Aztalan. It's one of the oldest member-owned tracks in the state of Wisconsin. It's beautiful. For me, I think it's something that I've been drawn to since the first time I went out there in 2006. Whether it's the mystique, the sort of the landscape, there's a lot of things that are triggering you in really good ways when you're out at a racetrack. And I think it for the most part starts with the people.
And you mentioned amateur and pro racers. Once somebody goes pro, I mean, are they touring all over the country then?
Gosh, it really depends. I mean, I'm not making this film as a racer. I know that there are some professional racers that do tour all over the country or all over the world. And there are some that will stay local. It really depends on your budget and your time. So I think that it's not so much the level of commitment that somebody has, but it's how much access they have to do what they want to do.
Let's get back to Charlotte Kanes now for a few moments. Talk about her career, how she started in racing and where she went with it.
Well, Charlotte started, like many kids do, at a local district track, which in her case was Aztalan. That was District 16 in Lake Mills, Wisconsin. And it's really a matter of going through the ranks of a race, going through certain ranks in a race career. So it's collecting a certain amount of points to, be recognized in the district. It's reaching a certain age when you can get your pro card. And then it's really having the backing, which is usually sponsors and family, to get you through to certain levels where you've got the finances and the access to do what you want to do. Her race career was very short. Charlotte died on the last day of the end of her first professional season. So she was just ready to get out there and start making a name for herself. And she really did up to that point. I mean, there's no one in flat track racing who doesn't know who Charlotte Kanes is. But again, she was just starting out. She was a formidable competitor. She loved the sport. People loved her. She had a great community around her. And it was, an incredible loss. Definitely gone too soon.
And while there is this tragic loss, I understand you're not pitching this as a cautionary tale. This isn't a sad story. You don't want to discourage young girls or anyone from getting on a bike.
I don't want to discourage anyone from just pursuing what they feel that they want to do or having access to do what they want to do. The project is a labor of love. There is definitely a struggle with loss that you deal with, making this how you're going to kind of manifest your connection to Charlotte. It's a challenging project along those lines, but really incredibly worthwhile, not only for myself and being able to honor Charlotte, but I think that it will just play a role with people who did connect with Charlotte and who will now have an opportunity to connect with who she was and who she is to people.
Of course, Charlotte's passing was a loss to her friends and family and to the community of racers. How did it affect you, though, as someone you've been watching her for literally a decade, and all of a sudden this happens?
I think for me, it's devastating not to have Charlotte with us. I'd rather not be making a film with this storyline, of course. It's something that I think most of us rarely embrace fully because it's just too difficult. It's only been a year. It's something that is it's immeasurable, you know. So I think that honoring somebody or keeping that life force nearby or staying connected to that life force that somebody has is one way that you manage. And again, this is about honoring and celebrating who she is to not only me but to her friends and family. And that sort of trumps trauma. You know, I think you have to just move forward because that's the only way to go with this. But there's no describing the element of loss in this project. There just isn't. So you just don't. You know, everybody can acknowledge, you know, you can't really acknowledge what it's like not to have Charlotte here, but we're all going through something in our own ways, but I think that it's all connected through how much we really did love her and do love her.
And now you've wrapped, I understand, filming, but what's the next step toward now completing the project?
Well, we actually haven't wrapped filming. I'm just about to launch an Indiegogo campaign to help us with the final filming, which is probably a couple dozen interviews that want to be in the can. And then I'll be editing story throughout the course of probably the winter and into spring, maybe some of summer, do some pickup shooting next summer, and then pull the film together in 2018 and get it out as soon as possible.
All right, Wendy, thanks for joining us and good luck with the project.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That was Wisconsin filmmaker Wendy Schneider. We've been talking about her new project, Angels of Dirt. You can find more info at angelsofdirt.com. The nation is still trying to heal from the tragic shooting that killed 58 and injured hundreds more at a Las Vegas music festival. After the shooting was over, the press scrambled to tell people what was happening.
In the countless reports and statements that followed the tragedy, terms like lone wolf were used to describe the shooter.
In the terrorism studies field, lone wolf attackers are generally defined as an individual or individuals who have no contact whatsoever with established terrorist group.
The Chertoff Group and an expert on lone wolf attacks.
This is an individual who was described as a lone wolf. I don't know how it could have been prevented if we didn't have any prior knowledge to this individual.
People try to fill in the blanks naturally. And so in this situation, the question is, was he acting as a lone wolf by himself or was there an accomplice?
The police said he was responsible for the deadliest attack in modern U.S. history, and that had many asking why the shooter wasn't just identified as a terrorist.
Our next guest says that calling him a lone wolf can expose a double standard about how we identify certain criminals, and he says it has a lot to do with the perpetrator's race or religion.
Khalid Maydoun is a critical race theorist and associate professor of law at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law, and he's written about this for the Washington Post. Khalid, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What kinds of assumptions do you think were made about the Las Vegas shooter fresh out of the gate there after the tragedy?
Yes, yeah, so the immediate presumption or assumption was that there were no ties, no connections to either a terror ideology or a terror network, but largely on grounds of his race, of his whiteness.
And what difference do you think it makes, if you can talk us through some of the associations with the different terms that we start to look for as markers into what kind of case might be unfolding? There are the phrase lone wolf, in this case, local man, and at the other end that you're talking about, we hear the word terrorist. What do these different terms mean?
Yeah, well, they mean dramatically different things, especially lone wolf, localer, and sometimes you have the assessment of, insanity that are swiftly made when the culprit is white. What those mean essentially is that they qualify as an exemption from the possibility of terrorism. They're deployed intentionally, oftentimes to, you know, disconnect an actor like Paddock from the possibility of terrorism. Whereas when we compare his case to the cases of, Muslim or Middle Eastern actors, you see the opposite happening. You see a swift presumption, a swift branding of that actor as a radical or a terrorist to make that connection.
And who do you think is responsible for this type of characterization for the public? Is it the press? Is it the law enforcement? Who gets to make those calls?
Yeah, well, I think it goes deeper than, blaming law enforcement or, blaming the media. I think it's just, especially since 9/11, you have just, a very embedded and entrenched racialization of specific segments of the country, Muslims and Middle Eastern and, Arab populations as being inextricably tied to terrorism, unfortunately. And that's obviously bolstered by the war on terror and specific laws that carry forward the war on terror. Whereas, the long legacy of race and racism in this country, especially with the way we think about whiteness, is that, it disconnects whiteness, essentially disconnects individuals from collective action or collective guilt. But we see law enforcement and media essentially, echoing these narratives.
Let's talk a little bit about the idea of collective guilt, which is something that comes when you were talking about labeling someone a terrorist, and then presumptions are made that that person might be a Muslim terrorist, and then that they have affiliations with a greater community. And we talk about collective guilt. What happens when that label ends up being used in a situation, maybe accurately or inaccurately?
Well, it kind of unfolds in, along two streams or two lines, if you will. So we first see it with, the culprit himself or herself, that there's the immediate idea that that individual cannot be a lone wolf, that that individual was not acting in a solitary capacity, that he or she must be connected to a broader collective. And typically that collective is a terror network. We also see it kind of spill over, into the experience of Muslim Americans at large, right, where there's this, immediate kind of call, immediate kind of command from whether it be the state or the media to disavow or apologize for the actions of a culprit like an Omar Mateen or the Orlando shooter or the actions of the two culprits in San Bernardino, which, again, just highlights the idea that all Muslims, regardless of, where they are and where they were when something like that took place, were in some way connected.
So do you think that if, for example, there is an act that's perpetrated by a white shooter, or even if you look at the racist rallies in Charlottesville, yeah. Not rallies isn't the right word, but does that absolve certain communities of guilt that wouldn't be absolved in other situations?
Yeah, exactly. I think that, the Charlottesville riots or whatever you want to label them are a really vivid example of how you you don't have that same phenomenon of collective guilt or association being leveraged or being assigned to whites, right? So for instance, when those riots led to the death of three individuals, there was no broader call on the part of the media, the mainstream media or the state, for whites or even, not whites at large, but, whites, for instance, who had, white supremacist kind of leanings to have to disavow or apologize for those incidents.
We're talking right now with Khalid Beydoun. He's a critical race theorist and associate professor of law at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. And he says there's a double standard when it comes to deciding who is called a terrorist. And Khalid, it seems as though we're at a point right now in our culture where we don't really know, when we see these large acts of violence, we don't agree about what a terrorist is. You have a definition for that.
Yeah, well, I don't have, kind of a finite technical definition. What I do is to kind of grapple with the idea that Muslim identity should not be presumptive of terrorism. I think one of the shortcomings in our, body of, law is that there isn't a precise and kind of consensus definition for terrorism. Now, if you were to ask me to offer a definition of terrorism, I would be inclined to kind of construct it in a way to strip it away from a specific racial or religious identity and focus merely on the violence that's inflicted and the idea that it's motivated by some sort of hate, some sort of, violent kind of viewpoint.
Does that distinguish it at all from a hate crime?
Yeah, there's an interesting overlap between hate crimes and acts of terrorism. And the legal distinction kind of rests upon which groups are designated as hate groups and which groups are designated as terror groups, right? So oftentimes, white-led or white-populated groups in this country are not fully designated terror groups. That's why you don't have many incidents that are carried out by, you know, white supremacists being designated as terrorism and so on. But I think that there really needs to be critical thinking about having a broader kind of designation of terror groups that does not only include, Muslim actors.
Right now, Khalid Beydoun stays with us. He's a critical race theorist and associate professor of law at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. And we're talking about how our guest says there's a double standard when it comes to deciding who gets called a terrorist.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think. Do you think there are double standards when it comes to labeling people with words like terrorist or lone wolf? How do you think the Las Vegas attacker and other mass shooters should be characterized? Do you think counterterrorism efforts are should be targeted at more groups than they currently are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We're picking up the conversation with Khalid Beydoun. He's a critical race theorist and associate professor of law, and we're looking at what he describes as a double standard when it comes to deciding who gets labeled a terrorist.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of how the media, law enforcement, and others label people who make these mass public attacks with terms like lone wolf or terrorist or not one of those? Do you see double standards or religious, racial, ethnic bias when identifying these attackers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And we go to our callers now. We have Mike joining us first in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I remember learning in the 60s that terrorism, the definition was a group that causes fear or terrorizes another group of people. And if I recall correctly, the term lone wolf, that is somebody that is called to do terrorist acts. I believe the word is what, stochastic terrorism, where you have a TV show and you say this abortion doctor needs to be killed, and then the next night you say this guy needs to be murdered, and then one of these lone wolves goes out and kills them.
What is the term you use for that?
I think it's what, stochastic. Terrorism. I believe that's what it is.
Metastatic, maybe something. Got it, Mike. Thank you for those thoughts. And Khalid, what is your response to some of these terms and how they may have changed over the years?
Yeah, so the terms have changed because our understanding of terrorism has changed. In the 60s, the framing of terrorism and the concern with terrorism the state had was largely with state-sponsored terrorism. So the primary culprit at that time was the Soviet Union. It was a nation state that kind of, threatened state-sanctioned terrorism against the United States. In the 90s, it was more along lines of transnational terror networks. Now it's individuals. Instead of soldiers of a terror network inflicting terrorism or, agents of a nation state, it's individuals who are functioning in a solo capacity. So it's fluidly shifted over time.
Mike, thank you for the call. And we go next to Kaiser from Milwaukee. Kaiser, hi.
Yes. Before we start, I am a Muslim. I've lived in this country for about 37 years. So every time, for example, this what happened, and I feel very guilty even saying it, that when this thing happened in Las Vegas, and when I saw the news, and at that time we did not know who he was, and the only thing I could, and I feel ashamed even thinking, and I was praying, I hope, oh Lord, I hope he's not Muslim. Well, then I started thinking, okay, I started praying, oh God, I hope he's not a Latino, because the wall is about to go even higher if he's a Latino. And, you know, a lot of times, for example, we bring, this guy in Orlando, the shooter, he was just a human who was going through a conflict between his religion and his gayism, and him being a gay. And why could we not? It could have been a born-again Christian who was going to the same, and he could have, why did we have to bring Muslims into this? Timothy McVeigh was a born-again Christian. We did not hear anywhere. No leader came out and said, oh, God, we are going to go after born-again Christians because they're all terrorists. Why is it that when it's, you know, why do we have to worry as Muslims? Why do we have to worry about in this country? Where are we going with this whole scenario?
Kaiser, thank you for the thought there. And I want to start with his personal remark. When he first heard about this shooting, Khaled, he said he prayed, please don't let the shooter be a Muslim. And that's, I think, part of what you're getting at in your piece here.
Yeah. So, you know, stepping aside, you know, taking my, I guess, professor hat off for a second, you know, that is something that's experienced by Muslims across the board, especially since 9/11, even before 9/11, that when an attack or a shooting of this kind actually happens, that's just kind of the, you know, the thoughts that are, you know, really scrolling through our minds at that point, because we understand what the backlash will look like if it is, in fact, a Muslim. It's a psychosis that I think is, it's become so integral to the Muslim American experience and narrative, sadly.
And what about what he was getting at there, Kaiser, his other part of his comment about how come other groups are not kind of brought into the fold when there is a mass attack? And he did think about what would happen if the shooter had been a Latina. What would that mean politically? What does it say about the way that we are using sort of group politics to associate with acts of mass violence?
Yeah, and that's where race is really important. Like when we talked earlier about the idea of, you know, collective action, collective responsibility, that isn't something that's exclusive to Muslims, right? So we see that obviously with the experience of African Americans in the criminal context. We also see that with Latinx communities with regard to, you know, how individuals who are undocumented or quote unquote illegal are caricatured, and the specific, you know, kind of stereotypical inclination that's tied to Latino identity with criminal deviance. So that idea of collective action responsibility is also tied to the experience of Latinos, sadly. So if the shooter, you know, was Latino or Black and so on, you'd see the same kind of, you know, damaging rhetoric that would hold the entire group as being in some way responsible.
I'm trying to take one more quick call here. Rebecca in Madison, you're next.
Yes, I just wanted to quickly comment for what it's worth and say that I believe anyone who's committing any act of terror or anything that's supposed to cause fear or any kind of political thing should be labeled a terrorist, regardless of where they come from, their political persuasion, their religious belief, or their ethnicity.
Rebecca, thank you for the call. And Khaled, before we let you go, I want to ask you in our last 30 seconds, how would you like to see the press, law enforcement, society approach things moving forward?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, in the ideal world, I would, you know, highly hope that instead of making immediate kind of assumptions or presumptions that are linked to racial and religious identity, that law enforcement, you know, thoroughly conduct an investigation before coming to a conclusion, whether the culprit be white, Muslim, Black, or brown.
Khaled, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Khaled Baydoun is a critical race theorist, associate professor of law at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. He says there are racial and religious double standards when it comes to identifying criminals as terrorists.